Okay. Well, we're going to continue for a few moments to talk about, a few moments more to talk about positive psychology. Now, there are some interesting things that once you start, you know, looking at life from this perspective, different things happen. There's a psychologist named Shelley Taylor, and she's very associated with health psychology. And she and her collaborators have argued that even unrealistically optimistic beliefs about the future can actually protect people from illnesses. And there are results from numerous studies of patients like with life-threatening diseases, say like AIDS. And these studies suggest that those who remain optimistic show symptoms later, and they survive longer than patients who confront reality more objectively. So that, I mean, it's an interesting and finding, because we you know, tend to emphasize in our culture, I mean, be realistic, you know, understand reality as it is. Actually, the findings have been, you know, it's people who have developed, you know, very serious illnesses, perhaps terminal illnesses, that those who are optimistic about it and say, that's okay, you know, I am going to fight this thing, and I don't think it's necessarily going to be as bad as it is. Those people actually go longer before they become symptomatic with the illness, and actually they lead longer lives. And now part of what Taylor found is that the optimistic patient is likely to practice habits that enhance health. So the person is actually doing positive things. And also, those people are more likely to enlist social support. They don't withdraw from their culture. And we know a lot of things about the fact that illness, that if you are that ill and you have a lot of social support, often you are able to deal with the illness longer. And it's also possible, but I do want to emphasize, it definitely is not proven, but it's possible that affective states may have a direct physiological effect that retards the course of the illness. So one of the things people are trying to study is the possibility that actually that emotion that makes you feel so optimistic plays some real physiological role in you that actually helps to ward off whatever it is that's killing you. Now, the work of people like you know, Taylor is very important because we know a great deal, as we've been saying all along, about negative aspects of what makes you ill, but we don't know a lot of things about how to promote positive growth. And so this has been an interesting finding. And the idea that people high in optimism and hope are actually more likely to provide them, it's interesting, they're more likely to provide themselves with unfavorable information about their disease. That is, if you're really optimistic and you think you can overcome this, we find that you'll probably study and find out a lot more about the disease, and then you know what you should do and you know what you should avoid. On the other hand, if you don't have this kind of optimism that, you know, you will do better than the average person with this illness, you don't bother to learn much about it. I mean, you become very passive in a way. You decide, you know, I'm going to die.
Sure. Has any research been done, like, about, like, negative affect and, like, its detrimental effects on health?
Not a lot, because, you know, in some ways we so clinically believe that that negative affect will, you know, cause you probably to not do the things that you need to do. That is, if somebody really is negative, then they may not take their medication because they feel it won't make any difference. They may not do anything that, you know, promotes their health because they feel, you know, it's too late anyway. So we've always thought that. So I don't know that the negative part has been studied as much and like how much that affects you. But it's clear the lack of a positive attitude will definitely have a difference in how long someone lives. We just don't know why. Now, positive psychology also has shown an interest in developing excellence in young people. And, you know, an often replicated finding, not great for people like myself who are professors, but the study has been done several times, and it shows that the average student reports being bored about a third of the time that they spend in school. So if they're bored about a third of the time, And if you consider that people go to school for about a fifth of their life, this is not good news. I got thinking about it. I thinking, you know, you could look at it that students report that they're bored about a third of the time that they're in your class. Or you could look at it worse and you could think, during the entire class, a third of the people out there are bored, no matter what I'm saying. But the fact is that's a lot of time. And one could argue then that, you know, given this factor, that youth in our society, you know, rarely have the opportunity to take initiative. That is, our learning paradigm still is pretty passive. That students come to class and students, you know, get information and read books, but a lot of the learning is passive. And so we're beginning to encourage people to get more active. And, you know, in some universities today, they're actually making it a requirement that students have to do some kind of public service. You know, work in a social service agency or work in some place in the community where they can, maybe a political agency, but where they can begin to experience themselves as making a difference, where they can experience themselves as making a contribution while learning at the same time. And the whole idea of active learning is very important, but we don't know enough yet about how to be effective. We do know that active learning is very powerful, and we do know that students report back. You know, if they've had an experience where you actually went and did something and you felt you learned from it, you have a sense, I will remember that. Very different than kind of, you know, passively getting the facts. Now also, you know, there really has been question in our society, and especially in some very difficult times, whether there really is any reason to be optimistic. And there's a marvelous story told about Charles de Gaulle, who was once the president of the French Republic. And de Gaulle was in this interview, and you know, a news person came up to him and said, "Mr. President, are you a happy man?" And de Gaulle looks at this person and says, "What kind of fool do you take me for?" And, you know, he kind of expressed what you know, life was like for him, that with all the issues France was facing, of course I am not a happy man. Well, that's too bad, because you really want people, especially leaders, to feel good about what's happening and to feel, even in the midst of the tremendous challenges that world leaders have today, that at least they have an optimism things are going to work out. And if we actually came to the conclusion, you know, that our world is too full of tragedy for people to be happy, that is, for real people to be happy, you know, we would have reached a very sad spot. And I think that the truth is, you really can be happy. That is, you can be happy, you can experience a sense of wellness, and you can experience a sense of creativity, and yet you can still acknowledge there are terrible things going on. There are things that I wish were not going on, but I don't have to allow myself to only experience the horror of what's going on. I can also develop a certain internal optimism that we will find some way to overcome this. Well, now, as you can see, in talking about positive psychology, we have been talking just very, very differently than we were talking about psychopathologies and other areas of personality theory. Now what I want to do is go on to the world in which clinical psychologists work. That is, what do they do with all this information they have, with all these theories? And we've only touched on a few theories, but they're very important ones. And as you can see, what we've touched on allows you to recognize you can approach life in a lot of ways. You could approach life from the early psychodynamic perspective, where, you know, very primitive feelings are breaking through or trying to break through, and you're trying to acculturate yourself in a society so that you don't let any of those feelings come through and cause you pain. Or you can be more in an Ericksonian world where you believe that you have a healthy ego that has its own energy and it's really striving for virtue and striving to cope. You can believe you're in a world like Carl Rogers described, where you know, your interpersonal life is extraordinarily important, and much of your growth is going to be through your interpersonal experiences and how effective you are in dealing with small interactions, that is, with one or two people, and how effective you are in dealing with large groups. We can go on and say that, you know, you can kind of forget about the past, like many of the cognitive behaviorists would tell you, and focus on, like, what is it you're experiencing right now? Where do you want to go? And let's see how we can, you know, focus on your problem and get you there. Or you can look at it from the positive psychology point of view, that you don't have to have problems, identifiable clinical problems, certainly, to get interested in psychology. That psychology should be a force in our culture to help you to become simply a better person. Even though you may be a very effective person right now, you can become a more effective person, and we should have ways to help you with that. Well, now we're going to see, you know, when psychologists are confronted with various challenges, what do they do? And we're going to start, and much of this is in Chapter 3, and we'll follow the book a good deal when we go through this. But assessment is an extraordinarily important activity in clinical psychology. And depending on your frame of reference, of course, assessment does take on different meanings. So if you're if you have a psychodynamic or a behavioral approach to things, you know, doing assessment is very, very important. Where you will recall in Rogerian you know, thinking, assessment was something that kind of unfolded over time. You know, you didn't just go in and do an assessment of someone. Rather, you came in and you got to know the person. And over time, you got to know more about the person's problem. Now, in clinical psychology today, and in fields like health psychology, you know, neuropsychology, forensic psychology, assessment is extremely important. I mean, you have to do very top-notch assessments if you are going to be effective in those fields. Now, there are all kinds of assessments that psychologists do. They do assessments for school preparation. They do assessments simply for IQ. But the assessment, you know, may determine whether a child gets into a class for gifted children or not. Psychologists do assessments about are people fit for the military. They also do assessments about are people fit to enter the seminary. Are people fit for specific jobs? Often psychologists will assess executives. You know, are they ready for the next move? Do they have the talents that are needed? There are assessments done for government positions, especially things, let's say, like someone is going to work for the Secret Service, the FBI, the CIA, and they tell you that right off, that if you're going to work for those agencies, you will be assessed by a psychologist. And you can see, you know, perhaps why, because these people have such responsible positions, and there are some, you know, virtues that are needed. I mean, one needs to have courage in those positions. One also, you know, needs to have a certain ability to keep information. One has to be interpersonally effective. One has to not be so dependent that they would reveal things they should not reveal. I mean, there are a lot of things you would assess for. Psychologists assess whether people are fit to stand trial. You know, very important issue. And you see it so often on television these days that you begin to recognize that, or you begin to think that there's a lot of that. Actually, if you take into all the trials that go on in the world, let's say all the trials that go on in our country, you know, there are relatively minuscule number of people who actually are found not fit to stand trial. But it's very important when people are found that way, because it, you know, our Constitution says it would be unfair to try them. Now, psychologists do lots and lots of assessments of fitness for psychotherapy. And part of those assessments are not only to determine is someone suitable for psychotherapy, but also to determine what kind of psychotherapy. Should there be an individual psychotherapy? And if so, should it be behavioral? Should it be dynamic? Or, you know, should they be seen in a group? Should they be seen as a couple? Should they be seen in family therapy? I mean, those are all very important questions that have to be answered. There are assessments of cognitive functioning, which, of course, is a very important area in fields like neuropsychology. There are assessments for physical treatments. That is someone motivated enough that you should put them in this treatment because they will benefit from it? And later I'll give you a striking example. Also, assessments are done to determine a diagnosis. And sometimes it's to determine a psychiatric diagnosis. In fact, that's probably the most common. But also psychologists do evaluations to determine physical diagnoses. For instance, I mean, there are some people who suffer from headaches, and physicians have tried all kinds of tests and found that they can't diagnose them. Psychologists often then are asked to diagnose the person. And often psychological evaluations help to determine and give us a certain understanding of why this person might have such a symptom. Also, you know, in the real complicated world of assessments, sometimes psychologists rule out psychological disorders and rule in physical disorders. When I was preparing this, I was reminded of a patient that was referred to me one time. An internist told me that this patient had pain in his throat, and he'd been complaining about this for more than a month, and they had worked him up very thoroughly in internal medicine, and they were convinced there was no reason for this complaint, and that there must be something psychological. So I evaluated this man, and I did what I thought was a fairly thorough assessment of him, and I concluded that there is no psychological reason for why this man should have pain in his throat. This man was not hypochondriacal. This man was not someone who somatized. This was not someone who had a lot of stress in his life. And in fact, there were no variables that I found that led me to think that this was a psychological problem. So I went back to the internist and I said, I need to tell you that this person has real pain. I do not think this is caused psychologically. I honestly think there is something physically wrong with him. Well, she was disappointed, and very understandably so, because you know this man had already been very worked up. And she says, okay, I will go back and look at things. So I run into her the next day, and she says, you know, I went back and looked. And she says, one thing I noticed was that actually there was a problem with his x-rays, that whoever did the x-rays actually didn't capture all of his throat. And so we're going to do another set. Well, they do another set of x-rays, and they find out indeed that this man had cancer. And kind of the sad part of this story is that not only did this man have cancer, but it was so serious that the man died within less than 2 months after this whole thing occurred. But what's important about this is that when you're a psychologist and you get a referral, you don't automatically assume that because the physicians, who ordinarily do a very thorough job, and today they have some very good tests to work with, but you don't assume that this person's problem is psychological. You have to assess and find some very positive evidence from the interviews you do, or if you use tests, or whatever, and whatever observations you make, and whatever skills you have in doing interviews and doing assessments, that you actually can reasonably explain why somebody might have the symptom or the problem they have. And in this case, I found I couldn't. I found that nothing seemed to me to indicate that I should diagnose this person as having a problem. And of course, it turned out that he didn't have it. Now, the theoretical orientation of the examiner also influences what kind of data are gathered. You'll see, that people talk about assessments and certain kind of data are gathered, but the data that you gather in an assessment often is influenced by the background you come from. So, for instance, if you come from a psychodynamic perspective, you'll get a lot of early life history. And not only do you gather a lot of early life history, but you make a lot of inferences from that history about why does this person have this problem. On the other hand, if you're a cognitive behavioral person, you may gather some history simply because you want to find out, you know, like how long term is the problem. But you're not very interested, in looking at historical causes, which you're trying to identify as precisely as you can. What is the problem that this person wants to deal with? And then you begin working out your plans with a very future orientation, like where are we going to go from here? And if you're from a humanistic perspective, then the data that you gather comes more from whatever the patient is willing to disclose. And what you do is you sacrifice getting a certain amount of data in order to develop a relationship with the person that will make that person feel safe to really tell you a lot of troubling things that probably someone can't reveal just walking in and talking to a stranger. Now, as you can see, if you come from kind of a client-centered approach, if you're going to do assessments in a lot of settings, you have to get beyond that because you have to be willing to ask a lot of questions. You have to be willing to use the best skills you have to develop an empathic relationship with people. But for certain, you have to be, at the end of the assessment, you have to be able to make some statements about someone. Now then questions come up. Why is the individual being assessed? Very important question. People are assessed for all kinds of reasons. Some are assessed, as I mentioned before, because they're seeking a job. Some are assessed because they're suffering some kind of psychological problem. And they're seeking relief from anxiety or from depression or from some other symptom. Some people are assessed because there's a cognitive dysfunction. And some people are assessed both, let's say, before and after neurosurgery to see what kind of deficits they experience after the surgery. Some people are assessed for other physical problems. Some people are assessed because it's routine in certain businesses to do it that way. Now, that raises the issue of who will receive and use the data that you get. After all, you're going to ask a lot of questions. And if you're an expert at doing this, you're probably going to get a lot of intimate detail. And so the question becomes like, you know, who are you doing this for? Are you doing it for someone who's going to be the therapist? And that might be someone else, or it might be you. Are you doing this assessment for the individual? That is, are you going to give feedback to the individual? Now, what might that be about? Well, an individual might come in, and that person wants to know, I don't know where I can best function. I don't know what I'm really interested in. I'm kind of stuck in my career. So you might do an assessment, and there are tests that actually are very helpful that will help you to be able to tell an individual that you probably, your personality, would probably do well in these fields, and you probably would find these other fields not very exciting for you. So you do the assessment, but the purpose is to give data back directly to the person who's come in to see you. Or is the information going to a company or to the military? Very difficult situation in many regards, because in order to get the job, the person's got to undergo the assessment. But the person doesn't want a lot of material being disclosed to their company, and there are things that, were they to be disclosed, would probably keep the person from getting the job. So when you interview someone like that, you have to develop a skill at asking questions that have just enough detail that they allow you to get the answers to the questions a company has. You know, is this person trustworthy? Is this person bright? Is this person interpersonally effective? Is this person highly motivated? Is this person someone who has a real stick-to-itiveness to the way they do things? But you probably want to be very careful about getting too deeply into other intimate details in their life because they would not want those known to the company. And that also affects, of course, then the kind of report you're going to write and what you're going to put into it. Now, if you're doing an assessment, let's say for the court wants to know, can this person stand trial? What the court might want to know, was this person, do you think this person was psychotic at the time they committed a crime? Actually, the court won't let you answer that question anymore. Now they just want to know, do you think this person has had a psychosis? But you're not interviewing the person for the person's sake. You're, in many ways, you're interviewing the person because the court has referred that person to you. And actually, your client is not the person in front of you. Your client is the court. And that's the group that's going to get the results. Same could be with a referral from a school. You know, the school may want to know, should this child be held back? Or is this child so disruptive that you think they can't function in this kind of school? They have to go to a special kind of school. Do you have a health professional, a nurse, a physician, an optometrist, other kinds of people, other professions, referring someone to you? And you're already preparing the report for them. That is, they have got to a point where they think that your expertise might really be helpful to them in diagnosing the problem that someone has, which usually means the problem is fairly complex, may not be easily diagnosed, but actually it's the other health professional that you're preparing the report for. Now, if you look in your text on page 89, there's a table that suggests data that are gathered during assessment. And if you look at that table, what I want you to recognize is some of the things there are really not accurate. For instance, it makes it appear as if one would follow an assessment, a certain protocol here, and especially if you look under somatic, where they say, well, you want to know the person's blood type, RH factor, kidney and liver function, etc. That's really not true. Psychologists don't normally seek those kinds of data unless the referral is very specific about, you know, someone has a kidney disease and the question is, you know, motivation for treatment of that disease. But otherwise, you really don't seek that kind of information. Psychologists in their reports often will make a physical description of the person, but ordinarily only those characteristics that might be meaningful. So you normally do not talk about the person's height and weight and eye color and other things that you see table on page 89. Your authors here are making such an attempt to be so inclusive about what's in an assessment that I think in many ways that table is misleading. And what you want to be aware of is that for much of that, psychologists simply would not seek that information. Now, when they get down to things like overt behavior they have things like, conversational skill, interpersonal assertiveness, you might ask people about their smoking habits, by the way, because if someone actually does smoke, that often plays a very significant role in their life. And in today's world, someone who is a smoker has to incorporate that into a very complex interpersonal world. Many people just don't want anyone smoking in their house. So if you are a smoker, it often means when you're with other people, you really either have to resist this urge to smoke or you have to go outside to smoke, which, at some levels people feel is a real put-off to them and a lack of accepting them. So you want to be sure that you know certain things like that. And in fact, in today's world, you do ask questions about addictions. You do want to know if someone drinks and how much they drink, or if someone is alcoholic, how long they have been in sobriety and things like that. Certainly the parts about, you examine the person's feelings, you try to, get a sense about their emotional life, And you always today want to get a sense about their environment. That is, you know, what kind of family do they live in, or what kind of work environment do they have? What are those kind of variables? But what I want to point out to you is that the author has gone overboard being thorough here. Now, the more information, or the more usual information, you'll actually find on page 90 in a text in table 3.2. And you'll see it says it's a case study guide. Now, this gives you more a feel for what a report looks like. You know, the first thing you do put down is identifying data. I mean, very concretely, you know, you usually give the person's name, their gender, their occupation. You may give their income, their marital status, all those kinds of things. And then you notice the very next thing is reason for coming to the agency, or reason for coming to see you. And by the way, this case study guide, in many ways, the interview follows much of this. That is, you find out about the recent situation of the person. You want to learn things like how they've been functioning lately, what are the symptoms, or what are the problems, or what are the reasons that bring them to see you. You then usually examine the family constellation. Now, depending on your theoretical orientation, you may ask different questions at this stage. That is, the family constellation for a psychodynamic person would start with parents. You know, what happened when you were a child? What happened developmentally as you grew up? If you're now married, what's going on in your family life now? If you are a cognitive behavioral person, family is more likely to mean the family you're in right now, that is you and your spouse, your children, whatever, or you and your lover, or whoever it is that, you know, is significant in your life now. But the cognitive behavioral person is not going to want to learn nearly so much about what went on with you as a kid. Early recollections for psychodynamic people. What's interesting about early recollections is that sometimes the early recollection is not all that important, but it's whether you have them or not. There are some people who, when you say, you know, what's your earliest memory? Some people can go back to age 2 and tell you something happened at age 2, may be able to identify that it was at age 2, at that age, because they know that the family, let's say, moved shortly after that. And so they know from age 2.5 on, they live somewhere else, and they can remember living at another place prior to age 2.5. There are other people, and it always would astound me, but it's true. It happens to individuals where when you say to someone, give me your earliest memory, their earliest memory they give you is from high school. And you say, well, can you tell me something earlier than that? Like, what grade school did you go to? Well, I went to Harry Truman grade school. And what about? Well, you know, what do you remember going on there? I don't really remember anything about grade school. I don't remember what happened there. And they're really telling you this. That, you know, basically, a psychodynamic person would assume is things must have been very difficult for this person. Here, this person got to be, 14 years of age? And they can't remember anything prior to age 14? So perhaps one wants to be very cautious then about exploring those things. Eventually, you'll explore them. But if we were to choose in this room to ask for an earliest memory, my guess is that each of you would not be revealing an early memory from the same age. Some of you might be able to go back very early to 2 or 3. Others might have their first memories age 5. Some of it maybe 6, 7, 8. It just depends. But you do gather that data, and sometimes there are data that you might like to gather, and it really is not available to the person. Okay. Now, the first question, by the way, in interviews, is to ask the person, what is their reason for coming? Now, you obviously don't ask that if the if there is a specific reason, like the court has referred the person to see whether they're able to stand trial, or the company has referred the person because they want you to assess whether someone has the skills to do a certain job. You don't ask them why they're there, because it's obvious why they're there. Now, let's take an example, though, of somebody who's coming for psychotherapy. And we can go through some of the usual questions. So they say the first thing you ask is, you know what brings you here? Now, you get very different responses from people. Somebody may come in and say, I'm coming to seek psychotherapy because I recently separated from my spouse and I'm feeling very anxious. Okay? Concrete loss, recent loss, person has real awareness of affect, so there's a real issue to resolve, and the person is aware of the feelings that he or she is having about this. That's very different than when someone comes in and says things like, I've been feeling very depressed lately, and I don't know why. And they're not really able to give you, much about that state. Now, what we have learned, and we'll get into depression a little later, is a good example of diagnosis, but the fact that someone says, I don't know why, doesn't mean they don't know why. It means that they may mean they have so repressed these feelings, and the reasons for the depression are so frightening that they're just not allowing themselves to be aware of it. However, we also do know that there are people who get depressed, and actually profoundly depressed, and there are physiological reasons for that. And that you're going to have to take a biological treatment in order to help that person. And so there are some people where antidepressants would be a much better choice for intervention than with psychotherapy. But when you interview people, you get enough information that you can make that distinction, to whether or not someone really ought to go on antidepressants, or whether this is someone who is probably depressed for very psychological reasons, and they may need time to feel safe with you before they can disclose some of the reasons. Or, in the case of the first person, they may even give you some reasons for why they're depressed right now. Now, the next thing that happens is, you usually ask the person, if they give you any problem, you usually ask the person to simply tell you as much as they can about the problem. You want to get the person who's being assessed talking, and you want to be able to observe about how open they are about problems. You want to be able to observe what are they willing to disclose. And also, often you pick up a lot of nonverbal information. You get to see when the person blocks. Often you get to see when the person clearly is hurting as they disclose certain information. But you've kind of given them the freedom. You're not demanding it from them. You're simply asking them to tell you about it, and people freely begin to explore these things. Now, then, depending on the information you get, the interviewer usually starts with gathering safe data and then works towards, more emotionally loaded data. So you might ask questions about, someone's general history, so you can kind of determine their background. And then only later would you ask them about intimate relationships or their marriage or other events that are going on in their life that you've already determined are probably pretty emotionally loaded. Now, I've said to you that if you come from a Rogerian orientation, you really emphasize developing a relationship with a person, that becomes really key. And I can't emphasize enough that it isn't just coming from that orientation, but actually, no matter what your orientation is, if you're going to be an effective clinical psychologist, one of the first things you have to learn and you have to make important is developing skills that allow you to talk with someone about very, very important things in their life in a very safe way. So that relationship that develops between whoever is doing the assessment and the person being assessed is key right from the beginning as to whether or not you're really going to get information from someone, and especially whether the person's ever going to disclose to you the things that you probably most need to know. Now, many therapists will want to gather history early in the interview. Part of that is to develop a sense about, you know, how chronic is the problem the person brings. So you may ask the person questions about their parents, about their siblings, about their experiences in school, about, you may take a fairly thorough job history, find out, you know, what they've done, how successful they've been. By the time you gather all that information, you do have a lot of information about the kind of life a person has lived, what kinds of rewards they've had, whether they felt safe as they were growing up, whether they took risks, whether they're now working at a level that's probably commensurate with their ability and their education, whether they may be working at a level much lower than what their talent would allow them to, whether they're in a good relationship or not. And you have to be careful, because what you think is a good relationship may not necessarily be what this person is looking for. So you want to get a sense about whether or not the relationship the person is in is meeting the person's expectations. Now, as I said, just a moment ago, it's also helpful often to ask the person about early recollections. And it is important, if the people have early recollections, whether they're positive or negative. But it is striking when people have the ability to tell you almost nothing about their past. Now, part of history taking, in many cases, is also gathering something about the person's health and their physical condition. More and more, as we live in a biopsychosocial world, you really do want to know about the person's physical health. Obviously, you want to know a lot about them psychologically, but you also want to know a lot about the environment in which they live. And you want to know about a person's education or training. And as I said, you want to learn about their work record. Now, sexual development, which often is a very sensitive subject, might be the next information you gather. That is, when you've gathered all these other dimensions, you might ask a person about their sexual history. And this part of the interview can actually be instructive to the patient. If you do this well, one of the things you communicate to the patient is, we're going to talk about very intimate detail. And so you create an expectation for the person that it's really okay to talk about very intimate things. In fact, I'm bringing up intimate things, asking you about your sexual life, and asking you about how satisfied you are and how your partners feel about you, and if there are any problems, I'm asking you about them. But it becomes important, because it sets an expectation for the client that anything they want to talk about is fine. And for many people, they can tell you concrete things about themselves sexually, but it gets harder to talk about their sexual feelings. And so you often ask them to describe the kinds of sexual feelings they have. But in the beginning, you don't push them to describe more than they wish to describe. You can scare someone right out of treatment in the very first session by being so aggressive that they feel they're going to have to disclose things to you they're not ready. Now, some people, of course, can readily talk about their sexual feelings, because that's really not the basis of their problem. And it's important to recognize that some people may have much more difficulty talking about their anger, especially if, some rageful event occurred that brought them into treatment. So if rage is a difficulty for someone, then you want to start learning the dimensions of it. And it's interesting today, because people do get referred today because of rageful things they do. And when you're interviewing people, often they can tell you, and do pretty openly, tell you a lot about their sexual life, and a lot about their hostile life, that is the nasty things they've done, mean things they've done, things that have ruined relationship interpersonally. And I was thinking today that I would ask you, if you had a 35-year-old white male come in and they're being assessed for psychotherapy, what do you think, of all the things that you can imagine, is the information that you'll probably see when you ask this question? You'll probably see very high anxiety. The single question, 35-year-old white male. Give me some questions. Just, what are you going to ask the person that you think most of the people will get very anxious if you ask them this question? Surely you can think of a question. Okay, what kinds of relationships do you have? And you think you might immediately see a lot of anxiety if you ask that question. That's often a difficulty for 35-year-old white males. So, sure, okay. Come on, what other questions?
Describe your job.
Describe your job. That might be something that might elicit a lot of anxiety in someone. If they need psychotherapy, they're that age, perhaps their job is a problem. What else? Anything about their sex life. Now that's what we often think of as the thing that probably will create the most anxiety. You know, if you ask somebody a very intimate kind of question, that will create a lot of anxiety. But yet there's something that creates more anxiety. Can you think of a question? Here you're doing an interview. What do you think?
Could you ask them how they would describe themselves?
You would ask them that. And that does create anxiety in people. But there's still something more. Now think about this. It's not so obvious. It'll be obvious when I tell you what it is if you don't already figure it out yourself. But see, we tend to think of, if you ask them about a person about their interpersonal relationships, you ask them about their sex life, you ask them about their job, that these things will create a lot of anxiety. And they do create a lot of anxiety for people. But it's interesting, in our society, in more recent times, you know what people have real difficulty with? It's when you ask them, how much money do you make? It's astounding, and it might surprise you. A typical kind of response often, and 35-year-old male might say something like, well, I make last year I made $55,000. Of course, I worked overtime, and actually that got me up to $59,000. And then I have interest from a bank account, and that got me up to $61,000. And then I have some investments, and actually, you know, last year wasn't a bad year for me, so that actually got me up to $67,000. And of course, then my wife works, and she makes $33,000, so, you know, actually, we have an income of $100,000. But, you know, I think I'm going to get a raise this year. That'll probably get us up to $105,000. And people talk like this. I mean, just the way I'm telling you. You see anxiety pour out of them. And I remember one time seeing a person who actually said, well, last year I made $300,000, but I got a really lousy bonus. Anxiety becomes a big issue. That is, often people are evaluating themselves today on the basis of their income is them. Okay, we'll go on with this then in our next class.